I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the A to Z of David Bowie. I'm Mark Riley, and that colourful character is Rob Hughes.
As you'll be aware, the A to Z of David Bowie is free to download.
Lunacy.
But if you'd like to support us along the way and be a member of an exclusive Bowie club, you can, and here's how.
There's an exclusive Bowie members club called Cheap Things, and for just $5 a month, wow, you can be part of it.
Why? So now you're thinking $5 isn't much, but what exactly will I get for my hard-earned cash?
Well, in short, you'll get lots of great new exclusive material delivered to your door.
Well, computer, actually, Mark.
Via a system called Patreon.
That's right, Mark. Patreon is a payment system that allows you to contribute your monthly subscription and offers you a portal to access the exclusive material.
Material such as...
interviews with Bowie's cohorts and friends.
There'll be regular film Bowie quizzes.
Bowie guitar tutorials.
Unreleased archive written material.
Competitions.
And perhaps most impressively, short films featuring the Cheap Things team.
Ah, that'll be me, Mark, Howard Knock and Jason Reed.
Visiting various Bowie places of interest.
And much more besides.
All this for just $5 a month.
So if you can't resist, simply go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/cheapthings, or one word, and join up.
There's also a website,
bowie@cheapthings.com.
Book early.
S is for the Serious Moonlight Tour.
So the Serious Moonlight Tour was launched in May 1983 in support of David Bowie's album Let's Dance. The tour opened at the Vorst Forest National in Brussels on the 18th of May 83 and ended in the Hong Kong Coliseum on the 8th of December. 15 countries visited, 96 performances and over 2.6 million tickets sold. Ka-ching!
Ooh.
We did talk about this as well previously, but this that was the green light for David Bowie, 1983, wasn't it?
It was.
To start making money.
It was. He was on a new contract. He just signed to EMI and he had loads of cash in the bank. And they said, tell you what, go off on tour, see what you can bring back.
Yeah, I had a chat recently on Cheap Things with Di Davis. And he's a brilliant fella, really great. And he started working with Bowie just before Main Man kicked in. And he was there when the contract negotiations came in with RCA and everything. And you know, he was there and he was a friend of Bowie's before Tony DeFries came into the frame. And so, he knew what went on. And he did think that David Bowie would not have made it without Tony DeFries. And so, you know, the arguments rage, don't they, as to whether he would have made it without Angie and whether he would have made it without Tony DeFries. Mm. I think it is fair to say, after all of the research that we've done, then both of them were serious players, weren't they?
Definitely. Also, I think there's two separate issues there, isn't there, with DeFries? There's no doubt Bowie couldn't have got where he was without DeFries, but then the arrangement, the financial arrangement he seemed to have with Main Man didn't really suit Bowie, as it perhaps should have done, we might say, in hindsight. Am I covering all my bases there legally?
Anyway. I think you probably did. No bad thing, mate. No bad thing.
So anyway, the tour itself drew mostly favourable reviews from the press. It was, at the time, Bowie's longest, largest and most successful concert tour to date, although it's since been surpassed in length, attendance and gross revenue by subsequent Bowie tours.
Most certainly. So the tour, designed to support Bowie's latest album, Let's Dance, was initially designed to be a smaller tour, playing to the likes of 10,000-seat indoor venues around the world, similar to previous tours that Bowie had undertaken. So, you know, that we're talking now about Wembley, aren't we? Wembley Empire Pool.
Yeah, that's right.
The NEC and all that kind of stuff, which he did play anyway. But we could have seen him at one of those venues, if only, instead of at Milton Keynes with 59,998 other people.
Well, the thing was, I was talking to Carlos Alomar last summer about this tour, and he said they started out with all good intentions, you know, as you just mentioned there, playing, thinking they were just going to play in venues of between, you know, 5,000 and 10,000, you know. The demand was massive. As Bowie hadn't been seen on tour for 5 years, had he, since the Isolar 2 tour. And so it was unprecedented. It was only like in the very last stages where the record company suddenly said, hey, we need to really bump this up a bit here and start playing arenas and outdoor venues.
Well, everybody was taken a little bit aback by the success of Let's Dance. I mean, yeah. It is a great pop album, there's no doubt about it, but it just absolutely took him off into the stratosphere, didn't it? Because he'd had all those kind of like the weirder years and, you know, the Berlin trilogy and all that kind of stuff, whereby, as we've just discussed, he wasn't that bothered about making money because he thought, the more money I make, the more money that goes into Tony DeFree's pocket.
Yeah.
And then he kind of dipped his toes in the pop water with Scary Monsters. And that worked with Ashes to Ashes. So he just thought, right, I'm going to go to the next level now or do my best. And I don't even think Bowie saw what was coming next.
Well, no. I mean, you know, famously, the instruction for Let's Dance to Nile Rodgers was make me a hit album.
Yeah.
But he couldn't have imagined it was going to be this huge.
No.
Global. So, however, you know, the success of Let's Dance caused unexpectedly high demand for tickets, as we've mentioned. There were 250,000 requests for 44,000 tickets at one show, for example. As a result, the tour was changed to instead play in a variety of larger outdoor venues.
Okay, the largest crowd for a single show during the tour was 80,000 in Auckland, New Zealand. That is quite phenomenal, that.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you know, I don't know these things, and you're the brain box of the operation, Bob. How many people live in New Zealand?
Well, I'll tell you what, Mike. In 1983, the population of New Zealand was 3.199 million, actually. So 80,000 is a sizable chunk of that.
It most certainly is. Yeah, incredible. Okay, and the largest crowd for a festival date was 300,000 at the US 83 Festival in California. The tour sold out at every venue it played. Of course it did.
Too right, too. Bowie himself had a hand in the set design for the tour, which included giant columns, affectionately referred to as condoms, as well as a large moon and a giant hand. The stage was deliberately given a vertical feeling, especially due to the columns, and an overall design that Bowie called a combination of classicism and modernism. The weight of one set, of which there were two, was 32 tons.
So you're saying that the columns were affectionately referred to as condoms?
Yes.
Maybe the large moon should have been affectionately referred to as the anus.
Oh, Mark. If only Bowie had thought of that. In fact, he might have done.
Oh, he would have been kicking himself afterwards. Oh, why didn't I? Anyway, the tour musicians, Bowie hired mostly musicians he'd used on his previous albums, though some of the musicians from his 1978 tour were rehired for this one, including Carlos Alomar, who was a designated band leader.
Yeah, Stevie Ray Vaughan, who contributed guitar solos to six of the songs on Let's Dance, and who was an up-and-coming artist, was to join the tour, also to please, well, perhaps to please the American audience.
Well, sure. We're going to go into Stevie Ray Vaughan, aren't we? So we don't have to pick the bones out of that just yet. Stevie Ray Vaughan showed up for rehearsals in Dallas in April. Soundboard tapes from the rehearsals exist. I know this because I've got the bootleg. It's called The Duke Meets the Hawk, or The Duke and the Hawk.
All right.
And it's great, you know. I mean, it's obviously different to what you hear when the tour actually kicked in with Earl Slick. But you can see why Bowie would want Stevie Ray Vaughan in there, because he could just go off on one. And I know that Mark Radcliffe did an in-concert for Radio 1. He produced an in-concert for Radio 1 with Stevie Ray Vaughan, and he was telling me about how he had this amazing guitar sound. He thought, how's he getting that sound? It's just like unreal.
Yeah.
And then after the sound check, he went backstage and then followed a cable through the back up the stairs. We know this terrain, don't we? Because we did the Cheap Things trip to the Manchester Apollo for Iggy when Iggy played there with Bowie. And he followed this cable up and into the dressing room, where he found another Fender Twin amp mic'd up.
Right.
So he had one Fender Twin on the stage with him.
Yeah.
And he had another one snaked off up in the dressing room, which is obviously all brickwork, mainly, with a natural echo in it, with the microphone on it. And that's how he got that incredible sound, in a live style, anyway.
Fantastic.
Okie dokie. And so, anything else to say there?
Yeah, did he show up with a cocaine habit?
Well, this has been documented, hasn't it? But I don't know, I didn't ask him.
No, all right. This is Stevie Ray Vaughan, of course, and not Mark Radcliffe. And the hard-partying wife.
Thank you for pointing that out, Bob. It could have got me in some serious bother.
Anyway, given that Bowie himself had moved to Berlin in the late 70s to try and kick his own cocaine habit, Bowie and Vaughan's management failed to come to an agreement on how to temper the situation, and in the end, Vaughan pulled out of the tour.
So there have been various stories as to why this happened, haven't there? I mean,
yeah.
So I've not heard that story about him having the cocaine habit or the crazy wife.
That was a new one on me. But as I say, we will go into this in detail when we talk about Stevie Ray in a bit.
We will, yeah. Okay, then. So this is funny. This is kind of like a bit of a Russian roulette, if you like. So the supporting acts. We'll do the Chuckle Brothers on this, Bobby.
Okay, all right. So, all right. Men at Work.
Well, there you go. You see that? The bullet went off immediately. Well, and the Beat.
Ice House.
UB40.
Or the Tubes.
Well, there you go. That's where I'm in at that point.
I'm into.
Yeah. And moving on to Peter Gabriel.
Wow. The Go-Go's.
Madness.
Dexys.
Television.
Big Country.
Rough Trade.
And Amazulu benefit show.
Right, okay. So, I mean, if you got Peter Gabriel on this tour, you did well. Or television. Oh. Or Dexys. Yeah. Or the Tubes.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's each to their own, isn't it? I mean, I'm presuming that Men at Work were the opening act in Australia.
Probably, yeah, so, you're right. But, I mean, they must have been thrilled, that opportunity, mustn't they?
I would have thought so. Do you know what? A mate of mine, and I've got a mate, but he's just recently got to know Kevin Rowland.
Oh, yes, right, okay.
My mate, he's called Matt. He's a big fan of Dexys, and he was just sat next to him on a train, and he's like, oh, you know, Kevin Rowland's got a reputation for being quite feisty.
Yes, yeah.
And Matt was just thinking, oh, it's one of them situations. Do I say anything to him? Do I just let it go? And then he just couldn't help himself. And he said, I just want to say, Kevin, I'm just a massive fan of yours. And he was just off on one then. He was just like, and they're good mates now.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And Matt just said he's just an amazing fella. And he's, you know, just, yeah, absolutely.
He is a fascinating guy. He really is.
Oh, completely. I've asked my mate to just ask him if he's got any stories from the Sirius Moonlight Tour. Because you never know. It might have just been the case that they had a porter cabin at one end, had a furtive nod at each other, at one point, and then that was it. Or he might have ended up like playing a few gigs on that tour.
Yeah.
I don't know. And getting to know him a bit. So I saw him. If it's a story to be told and Kevin will tell it, then we're going to go for it for Cheap Things.
Oh,
anyway.
Great. Okay. Yeah, worth a shout. Definitely.
Okay. So, onto the song selection. So Bowie and Carlos Alomar selected the initial list of songs for the tour, 35 of which they rehearsed. One song that was on the rehearsal list that never actually got to the rehearsal stage was Across the Universe, which Bowie had covered on obviously Young Americans album. Now, we'll get into the whys and wherefores of that later.
Yeah. Initially, the band rehearsed in a studio in Manhattan before moving to Dallas to do some dress rehearsals. Each band member wore a costume which was designed down to the smallest detail, as if in a character in a play. This is a recurring thing in Bowie live shows, well, the extravaganzas anyway. Two sets of each person's costumes are made and worn on alternate nights, and everybody got to keep one at the end of the tour as a souvenir. How nice.
So I have to wonder if Bowie kept any of the Spiders Club, you know. Because I know that Bowie, if he gave one to like the Sims Brothers or whatever,
yes,
then he probably kept one himself.
Yes.
We know that's how Bowie rolls. But, you know, I wonder if he kept any of the Spiders gear, because I know I have asked Woody about this and I asked him if he kept any of his gear. And, you know, it ended so badly for Woody, I can imagine him just getting him and sticking him in a bin bag and thinking, bollocks to you.
Yeah,
you know?
Or just having a giant bonfire.
Maybe, yeah. But Woody's actual explanation, he said that they were all falling apart, you know, because they were working so hard. So you've got a drummer in some crazy clobber and you're sweating like Billy-O on stage, and he said they were just kind of coming apart at the seams.
Well, I suppose it was a different level of touring, wasn't it? Because Bowie wasn't a superstar at that point here. You know, Sirius and Moonlight, he's on private jets all the time, so they're not kind of having the same wear and tear, or not in the back of a tour bus, let's put it that way.
There's something to come later about his shoes. So,
oh, yeah, I know.
So, yeah, we'll go on to that anyway. But, yeah, okay. And also, he said that the band's costumes were a nod, a slight parody, to all the new romantic bands that were growing in popularity at the time. So, obviously they've got the big suit for Bowie, but everything else is very ornate. And obviously, as we know, the new romantic thing kind of it bucked the trend of punk rock, didn't it?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
So there you go.
Okay, that's a good one. To discourage counterfeiting, tickets and backstage passes were printed with small flaws that casual observers wouldn't notice, but tour staff and security were trained to spot. That is real attention to detail there.
That's a brilliant idea.
It is. On the 30th of June 1983, the performance at the Hammersmith Odeon in London was a charity gig for the Brixton Neighbourhood Community Association in the presence of Princess Michael of Kent.
The 13th of July 1983, Montreal Forum performance was recorded and broadcast on American FM radio and other radio stations worldwide. The concert on the 12th of September in Vancouver was recorded for the concert video Sirius Moonlight that was released in 1984 and on DVD in 2006.
Yeah, at the Canadian National Exhibition Stadium performance on the 4th of September 83 in Toronto, Bowie introduced his special guest Mick Ronson, who borrowed Earl Slick's guitar and performed the Gene Genie with Bowie and his band. Mick who'd only been asked to play the day before. And well, he talked about it later. This is a great story. I know this story. It's such a great story because they bumped into each other. And I think Mick Ronson was slightly reluctant to play because the idea of playing before this in these huge stadiums, you know, in Toronto with Bowie again. But Bowie said, yeah, please come along, do it.
Yeah, well, we did two episodes, I think we did, on Mick Ronson, didn't we? And we did cover this, but he said I was playing Slick's guitar. I'd heard Slick play solos all night, so I decided not to play solos and I just went out and thrashed the guitar. I really thrashed the guitar. I was waving the guitar above my head and all sorts of things. It was funny afterwards because David said, you should have seen Earl Slick. Face, meaning that he looked petrified.
Yeah, he carried on. He said, I had his prize guitar and I was swinging it round my head and Slick's going, hey, watch my guitar, you know. I was banging into it and it was going round my head. Poor Slick. I mean, I didn't know it was his special guitar. I just thought it was a guitar, a lump of wood with six strings.
So the last show of the tour, the 8th of December 1983, was the third anniversary of John Lennon's death, whom Bowie and Slick had previously worked with in the studio. Slick suggested to Bowie a few days prior to the show that they play Across the Universe as a tribute, but Bowie said,
if we're going to do it, we might as well do Imagine. And so they rehearsed the song a couple of times on the 5th of December in Bangkok and then performed it on the final night of the tour as a tribute to their dear friend.
So, Legacy, the tour was a high point of commercial success for Bowie, who found his new popularity perplexing.
Yeah, he would later remark that with the success of Let's Dance and the Serious Moonlight tour, he'd lost track of who his fans were or what they wanted. One critic would later call this tour his most accessible because it had few props and one costume change from peach suit to blue.
Yeah, and Bowie did say that in a previous episode, we quoted him, where he was talking about how he would lose his audience every now and then, but they would come back to him.
Yeah.
It was one of those things where he knew full well that he was pushing his luck in one way or another, and certain elements of his audience would not like the change, which is natural, wasn't it?
I mean, of course.
If you've got somebody who loves Diamond Dogs, they're not necessarily going to love Young Americans.
No.
But, I mean, it transpires that most of them did.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go from Young Americans, like to Station and Low. And so it was all of those occasions where Bowie was testing his audience and pushing them and pushing himself. So when he says, you know, I don't know what people would make of this, the songs that they did spanned his career, didn't they?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing about this, I always thought, it was really, he wasn't sort of trying to change his audience, or not consciously anyway. The audience was always going to be there for this. It's just that he happened to grow a bigger one of people who wouldn't have been interested in Diamond Dogs and Young Americans and all that kind of stuff.
And youngsters coming through as well. I mean, who would never have heard Bowie before?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people who didn't hear David Bowie until Let's Dance and thought that's what he was, you know. Bowie later specifically tried to avoid repeating the formula for success for his Serious Moonlight tour with his 1987 Glass Spider tour. Well, he managed that all right, didn't he? No offence. And it does go to show, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That it doesn't matter how much kind of gloss and theatrics you put into something, if the music's not there and the arrangements aren't right and the image isn't right to a lesser extent, then it's not going to work. And it didn't.
No, yeah, you'll get sussed. So the personnel on the tour, David Bowie, lead vocals, of course, guitar and sax.
Earl Slick, guitar.
Carlos Alomar, guitar, backing vocals. Musical director too.
Carmine Rojas, bass guitar.
Tony Thompson, drums and percussion.
Dave Liebolt on keyboard synthesizers.
Steve Elson on saxophones.
Stan Harrison, saxophone woodwind.
Lenny Pickett, also on sax and woodwinds.
And George and Frank Sims, backing vocals. They get their own little spot anyway, won't they? So let's look at our own personal memories of the Serious Moonlight tour, because we both went to Milton Keynes, didn't we?
We did, yeah. I mean, it was just so great. I mean, you went... Well, do you want to go first? You went with Trace,
yeah, okay.
You?
So I went with my Mrs. Trace and my sister Tina and her husband Duncan, okay? And it was hot, I do remember that. And I do remember also that we got down near the front and we sat through Ice House, who I wasn't particularly keen on.
Mm.
And we sat through The Beat, who I wasn't particularly keen on. But we were pretty near the front anyway. Because let's face it, you know, if you're looking at 65,000 people in a natural auditorium, it's pretty damn cramped.
Yeah.
And so we just stood there and thought, right, we've got a good spot, we're going to stick it out. And pretty uncomfortable, but you don't want to move, do you? And of course, the minute that Bowie came on, a load of knuckle draggers came from the back, probably the aforementioned 1983 insurgents, you know, the new army of Bowie fans knew Let's Dance.
Yeah.
And they just came like herding the way down the front and just mixing it up and forming what was quite ridiculously a kind of a mosh pit, you know, throwing people out of the way. And my options were either to have a fight with a load of them or to retreat to the back with the wife, which of course I did the the latter.
Ah, nice one. Just let me just say, because you say that you took your sister there. I mean, am I right in saying that she was a slightly disparaging when you first got into Bowie in the very early 70s? So did she change her mind?
Oh, she changed her mind overnight.
Oh, I see.
That's okay. What happened. Now, I'd already seen Lift Off With Aisha. Tina hadn't. And then we were watching it on Top of the Pops, and I was already gone and, like, lost in it.
Right.
And just thinking, he's back. Right, okay. And Tina was mumbling disparaging words in the background. And my dad was as well, actually.
Was he really?
But again, I mean, like, Tina, I don't know what happened, but over the space of a week, she had a mate called Teresa who was absolutely blown away by Bowie on the night. And I think that Tina got convinced that she'd got it all completely wrong.
Right, okay.
And then got into Bowie in big style. And funnily enough, my dad was sat there going, what the... You can imagine, can't you? What the bloody hell? And, you know, just sat there, and I'm just like, oh, and Tina's not having it. And but of course, later on, I'd go around to my dad's house when he was in his 60s, and he would have Hunky Dory on. Or
brilliant!
You know, or he loved Bowie eventually. Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, I don't think he was so big on Low.
Stuff like I don't know if you're in a tranquil mood,
maybe.
But anyway, well, I got the coach down from Liverpool Lime Street. And it was a sweltering hot day, obviously, first weekend in July. It was so, so hot, and this coach was packed. But just everybody was so excited. I went with a mate of mine called Aid. I've no idea what happened to him from college in
South. What, on the day? You've never seen him
since?
But,
no, I haven't. Well, I have seen. Well, he was from a mate of mine from college in South, but I've not seen him and lost track of him after that.
I thought you lost him at Milton Keynes.
But he was. Well, I could have done. There's 60,000 people there, Mark. Mm. So we got there. I'm just so excited about it because, obviously, you know, the chance at last. I've always wanted to see Bowie, and there he was. We got, obviously, weren't near, like you, sort of near the front, but we just got nice little perch just on the side of the hill there,
right,
on the right of the stage. So Bowie's left if he was on stage, and it was just sensational. Just all these songs, one after another. Great spectacle as well, because even from there, you know, obviously it was designed to be a visual extravaganza, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and I love the fact he played stuff like Red Sails, which I just wasn't expecting.
And also, I mean, he was slightly strange because Bowie looked so great and so cool, but then you had the brass section who looked like Don Estelle from It Ain't Half Hot Mum, you know, but and everybody else looked really cool.
Yes.
And it was a strange one, actually, because I remember seeing, because I used to know Billy Duffy,
yes,
way back, yeah, and I know him a little bit still, yeah, and he's a great fella. So Billy Duffy, he was in Spear of Destiny, and now obviously The Cult.
Mm.
But I saw him coming out of an area that you needed to get a pass to get into, right, certainly, with Ian Asprey of The Cult. I saw him coming out and I thought, oh, should I go and say hello to him? Oh, no, I'll leave him. You know, they're already on the way up and all that kind of stuff. And so I was wondering, well, I just wonder if they've been hanging out with Bowie. And I don't know whether they had or not, mm-hmm, though I do know that John Peel tried to see David Bowie backstage at the Sirius Moonlight tour,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah,
And I believe he was at Milton Keynes. And the story goes, and whether Bowie knew about any of this or not, I haven't got a clue, but the story goes that he was sat there waiting for ages, and he would just see other people come through the door like pop stars,
yeah,
and being chaperoned straight through to go and see, you know, David.
Hmm.
And so whether it was just a PR thing and David didn't know that John Peel was waiting for him outside, but at the end, John just thought, oh, cobblers to this, I'm off.
And he went home.
And he went. And I also know Phil Lancaster, obviously at Lower Third,
yeah,
he told me that another member of the Lower Third tried to get backstage to see David at Milton Keynes and didn't even get as far as John Peel. So you would imagine that John Peel would have a VIP pass.
Yeah, but surely.
Not access all areas.
Yeah.
Well, I can't remember who it would have been. It was Graham or Dennis anyway.
Okay.
But one of them went and would have just had a ticket to get in, probably, yeah, and didn't get to see him. But for me, the thing is that I've not seen Bowie since Station to Station.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Since the Wembley shows,
because
I didn't get to see the Bingley Hall show, because by that point in time, I joined the Fall and I was off doing my own thing, you know. And so to leave it such a long period of time, you're looking 7 years in between the two gigs. And I remember being just absolutely thrilled with it when on the way home. It really was a remarkable thing, wasn't it?
It was everything you could have hoped for. It really was. I'm guessing for you as well, you know, it was so different to the White Light Tour. You know, a completely different look at everything and aspect.
Yeah, and I'd been in the Fall and been kicked out of the Fall by that point in time.
Right.
So, you know, I'd kind of got some experience of what it's like being in an abandoned on the road, but not playing at Milton Keynes Bowl to 60,000 people. But of course, I bought this quite recently. So it's Ricochet, David Bowie, 1983, An Intimate Portrait by Dennis O'Regan. And it's a great book. It really isn't. Obviously, was it you telling me that Dennis O'Regan fell out with Bowie at some point?
Oh, no, it wasn't me, but that's an interesting story. I didn't know that.
I think that halfway through the tour, maybe, I don't know what happened, and maybe it was Dennis O'Regan who told the story, it probably was, because there'd been lots of publicity about this book, and I'm not at all surprised. But I think that, yeah, Bowie just saw his arse, for want of a better phrase, with Dennis O'Regan at one point, and kind of gave him the cold shoulder for a bit, and then invited him back in, and then they got to know each other a little bit better, and it was always cool, you know, and he finished off doing the shots. And there'd been loads of publicity around this book, and there's a great shot of David on a plane looking behind him. Have you seen...
It's a brilliant shot, yeah. I know it.
And there's, like, you know, there's photographs of him here, like, having his jaws measured, you know, and they've got a lot of pictures of him with enormous domes, and they've got pictures of him with families abroad who haven't got a clue who he is, you know, around Hong Kong and all that kind of stuff. And Bowie, I mean, there's a great one. Bowie just lounging about. What would you call that? It's like a rowing boat, but it's not. It's a rowing boat that you would get in Hong Kong and you might go you'll go fishing
on. Absolutely, yeah. No, it is.
I'm not going to do any wildlife programs in the near future or travelogues.
You should after that, certainly.
But these here also, again, of him, you know, just like flitting about.
Yeah,
you know, on the water, in the waterways of Hong Kong and various other places. It's absolutely brilliant. And there is a great picture of Milton Keynes, and it was just showing, and I can see myself.
Oh, no, you can't.
No, I can, Bob.
Can you really? That's
no, no, oh, I can't. He tells loads of great stories through pictures. But at the front of the book, it's got his own kind of recollections of what happened.
All right. Okay.
So I think that we should just read a few paragraphs from this. 10 years after I'd first seen him on stage, I was introduced to David in a huge hangar in Texas, where he and the band were rehearsing. My first test was to accompany him early next morning to a local boxing gym, where he was sparring and getting into shape for the rigours of life on the road. On the first day, I arrived late, but he must have seen something like to me, because I got the gig anyway. I'm afraid it wouldn't be the last time that I showed up after everybody else, and "Where's Dennis?" became something of a catchphrase on the tour. It's a tribute to the brilliance of my artistry, or do I mean the tolerance of my famous employer, he said, that I made it to the end of the whole amazing journey.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that "Where's Dennis" thing? You think of all people on a tour, the photographer would just be ever-present, be everywhere. Get lost, Dennis.
You would expect him to be there lurking in the background, hoping to catch something that he's not supposed to catch, but no, "Where's Dennis?"
Yeah, anyway, so he continued. He says, "Serious Moonlight was an important tour for David. He'd been out of the public eye for some time. He hadn't toured after the release of his previous album, Scary Monsters, which spawned the hit singles Ashes to Ashes and Fashion. The good news for him was that this meant he had a wealth of material from two albums to perform live for the first time to his fans. He also included an eye-catching bit of stage business in the form of a routine based on Hamlet that he performed in the guise of one of his alter egos, the Cracked Actor. It was lifted from his 1974 Diamond Dogs review and hadn't been seen outside the USA before. While we're on the road, David's film Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence was released. He'd filmed it in Rarotonga in the Cook Islands shortly before we set out, so he was appearing in cinemas as well as topping the album and singles charts. Before long, he was selling plenty of concert tickets too. So he's everywhere, he's ubiquitous."
He most certainly is. And he continues, "There were 25 of us in the band and entourage. We were like family. We lived in each other's pockets, travelling on the same private jet, staying on the same floor of the same hotel, eating dinner together backstage before the show, sightseeing, partying. The band party travelled as a unit. It consisted of David himself, 8 musicians, security, administrative staff, wardrobe and makeup, and me. Meanwhile, the road crew went on ahead to build the stage. Inevitably, cliques formed. We British guys tended to hang out together, and that often included David. We were like a bunch of homesick expats. We would grumble at the lack of marmalade at the hotel or catch up with the English cricket results. Most of us prefer not to be reminded of our karaoke performances, but I will never forget David and I belting out a version of the Madness hit, Our House. The pair of us overcome by nostalgia for dear old England, even though, or perhaps because, we were a long way from our London roots. This was on the floor of the Red Shoes nightclub in Tokyo, and David was by this time a resident of Switzerland." So it's great. His recollections of the tour are absolutely priceless, and there's plenty of them in this book. And the photographs, as you will have seen all over the shop anyway, are great. So I would recommend it. I got it at a knockdown price in Marks and Spencer's, but you can find it wherever you like.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The A to Z of David Bowie, with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
So, continuing the story, Bobbert, in a similar vein, S is also for Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yes, born October the 3rd, 1954, died August 27th, 1990. He was an American musician, singer, songwriter and record producer, and one of the most influential guitarists in the revival of the blues during the 80s.
So Vaughan was born and raised in Dallas, Texas. He began playing guitar at the age of 7, inspired by his older brother, Jimmy. He dropped out of high school in 1971 and moved to Austin the following year.
Vaughan played gigs with numerous bands, earning a spot in Mark Benno's band, the Nightcrawlers, and later on with Denny Freeman in the Cobras, and he continued to work with them until late 1977. Then he formed his own group, Triple Threat Review, but renamed them Double Trouble in May 1978, taking the name from the title of an old Otis Rush tune. In early October 78, Vaughan and Double Trouble earned a residency performing at one of Austin's most popular night spots, the Rome Inn.
During a performance, Eddie Johnson, an accountant at Manor Downs, noticed Vaughan. She remembered, "I'm not an authority on music, it's whatever turned me on, but this did." She recommended him to Manor Downs owner Francis Carr and Chesley Milliken, who signed Vaughan to a management contract.
So Vaughan gained fame after his performance at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1982. People magazine wrote that he seemed to come out of nowhere, a Zorro-type figure in a riverboat gambler's hat, roaring into the 82 Montreux Festival with a 59 Stratocaster at his hip and two flame-throwing sidekicks he called Double Trouble. He had no album, no record contract, no name, but he reduced the stage to a pile of smoking cinders. And afterwards, everybody wanted to know who he was.
Wow, okay, so impressive stuff. So the Bowie connection now. On the night after the show, Double Trouble were booked to play in the lounge of the Montreux Casino with Jackson Browne in attendance. Browne jammed with Double Trouble until the early hours of the morning and offered them free use of his personal recording studio in downtown LA. In late November, the band accepted his offer and recorded 10 songs in 2 days.
While they were in the studio, Vaughan received a phone call from David Bowie, who met him after the Montreux performance, and invited him to take part in a recording session for his next album, Let's Dance. Bowie said of Vaughan's performance, "He completely floored me. I probably hadn't been so gung-ho about a guitar player since seeing Jeff Beck with his band The Tridents, who were Beck's band before The Yardbirds, of course."
That's right, and he also added, "As Stevie's music was such hardcore blues, I expected and would have understood a polite thanks, but no thanks. You can't imagine how delighted I was when he accepted the offer on the spot and said he'd love to try out a new kind of record just for the experience. When I asked him if touring could also be a possibility, he again replied in the affirmative. Hell yeah, he said. I tore real good."
Great. Vaughan carried on. He said, "To tell you the truth, I wasn't very familiar with David's music when he asked me to play on the sessions." This is when he was talking to Musician magazine in May 83. "David and I talked for hours and hours about Double Trouble's music, about funky Texas blues and its roots. I was amazed at how interested he was. At Montreux, he said something about being in touch and then tracked me down in California months and months later."
At Montreux, Bowie wanted to know where Stevie grew up. Double Trouble drummer Chris Layton told Billboard years later, "How did we all meet? Where did me and Tommy come from? Where did it all begin with the band? He was giving due diligence to find everything out that connected us. He seemed to be trying to realise the idea that Stevie would work on Let's Dance and that we'd all go on tour together, kind of testing the waters of what we could do and the whole concept of involving himself and Stevie."
It's interesting that, isn't it? Bowie's going out with a blues band, you know?
Yeah.
In January 83, Vaughan recorded guitar on six tunes from Let's Dance, including the title track and China Girl. The album came out in April that year, sold over three times as many copies as Bowie's previous record. Vaughan said at the time, "David Bowie's really easy to work with. He knows what he's doing in the studio and he doesn't mess around. He comes right in and goes to work. Most of the time, David did the vocals and I played my parts."
He also continued, "A lot of the time, he just wanted me to cut loose. He'd give his opinion on the stuff he liked and the stuff that needed to work. Almost everything was cut in one or two takes. I think there was only one thing that needed three takes."
Yeah, that was Nile Rodgers said that, didn't he? It was all done so quickly. So this is from an article now in Billboard that came out in October 2018, where friends and collaborators remembered the union of Bowie and Stevie Ray Vaughan. "It was just a trip to hear my kid brother on a number one record," says guitarist Jimmy Vaughan, who'd go on to work with his sibling and Let's Dance producer Nile Rodgers on the album Family Style. "Stevie called me to tell me he'd met up with Bowie and Nile Rodgers in New York, and I think they recorded him pretty quickly. It was only one day or something for the guitar. He just overdubbed himself onto the tracks, but he only needed one or two takes, as we just mentioned. He just went in there, all fired up, and did his thing."
With the success of Let's Dance, Bowie wanted Vaughan to be the featured instrumentalist for the upcoming Serious Moonlight tour, realising that he was an essential aspect to the album's success. In late April, Vaughan began rehearsals for the tour in Las Colinas, Texas.
When contract renegotiations for his performance fee failed, Vaughan abandoned the tour days before its opening date and was replaced by Earl Slick. Vaughan commented, "I couldn't gear everything on something I didn't really care a whole lot about. It was kind of risky, but I really didn't need all the headaches." Slick was required to learn all 30 songs in 72 hours before the first show in Brussels.
So with Vaughan's own Double Trouble album, Texas Flood, about to be released around about the same time, Carlos Alomar explained to Billboard, "There's always that place where a musician comes to be a superstar situation and thinks that it might be a launching pad. This might be the door that I've been looking for. When I met Stevie, it was about him saying, 'Dude, what are you doing? Nobody has founded their career from this.'"
So it's like Alomar giving him advice, saying, really, you know, you're just building. Why don't you just concentrate on building?
Well, it seems to be good advice if we continue.
Yeah, he continues. He says that he had to deny David. He wasn't supposed to be there. He was supposed to be promoting his debut, going out there and killing it, playing all night long and then getting in the car and driving to the next gig. Not jet planes and sushi chefs. I think that would have jaded his bluesness. Stevie was the real deal and he wasn't going to let anybody take that away from him.
Texas Flood went on to sell over 500,000 copies. The guitarist and Double Trouble would go on to produce three more studio albums of modern blues, with 1984's Couldn't Stand the Weather and 1985's Soul to Soul and 1989's In Step.
Talking about the decision to turn down touring with Bowie for Serious Moonlight, Layton said later, "Stevie had a major amount of respect for David and vice versa, but sometimes things just don't work out and Stevie didn't know if he could give his full commitment at that point. We were all trying to do things we wanted to do back then."
Layton continued, "Bowie saw us play and was so fascinated by Steve that he wanted to figure out how he could work him into what he was doing. I give Bowie so much credit for reading between the lines into our culture and sense something that might not have been as obvious to the naked eye." So, I mean, if you look at that and then compare it to the whole scenario with Mike Garson, it's the same thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, again, like with Mike Garson, as we know, he would be trying different things and Bowie say, "No, I want it weirder than that. No, I want it weirder than that, mate. No, come on, keep coming. What's that avant-garde stuff you do?" And with Stevie Ray Vaughan, it's like, you do what you do. Go in the studio. Because those guitar solos, the guitar solos are on, particularly on China Girl.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's the tone of that guitar is astonishing.
But yeah, the feel of it is just, you know, I mean, it is the blues after all that. So, you know, and fair enough, you know, he wasn't a rock and roll player.
No.
Just throwing out a load of licks. But it really it is such an amazing performance on that album.
Yeah. And like no other Bowie album either. You know, it was a real first for Bowie, wasn't it? So moving on to Stevie Ray Vaughan's demise. In the early hours of Monday, 27th of August 1990, Vaughan and members of Eric Clapton's touring entourage boarded a helicopter at Alpine Valley Resort in East Troy in Wisconsin to travel to Midway International Airport in Chicago. The designated helicopter originally had three seats available, but Vaughan ultimately took the last remaining seat, and the helicopter crashed into a nearby ski hill shortly after takeoff.
Vaughan and the four others on board, pilot Jeff Brown, agent Bobby Brooks, bodyguard Nigel Brown and tour manager Colin Smythe, were all killed. In the months that followed his death, Vaughan sold over 5.5 million albums in the United States.
On the 3rd of October 91, Texas Governor Ann Richards proclaimed Stevie Ray Vaughan Commemoration Day, during which a memorial concert was held at the Texas Theatre. In 1993, a memorial statue of Vaughan was unveiled on Auditorium Shores and is the first public monument of a musician in Austin.
Wow. I mean, I've been to Austin and it is just... I know it's where they have the South by Southwest Festival. But even back in the day, it was a little bit like a kind of, an equivalent of New Orleans in a way. But New Orleans would just be like bars and bars and bars bands playing, well, jazz, as you would expect. Yeah. It was just all the bar bands.
Was it?
You know, I mean, there was some kind of indie tinge stuff in there.
Yeah.
And a lot of, American boogie and things like that, and blues. So, you know, you could see it was, you could draw a direct comparison between New Orleans and Austin, as I remember it. Vaughan won 5 W.C. Handy Awards and was posthumously inducted into the Blues Hall of Fame in 2000. In 1985, he was named as an honorary admiral in the Texas Navy.
Wow,
strange, wasn't it? In 2003, Rolling Stone ranked him 7th amongst the 100 greatest guitar players of all time. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame alongside Double Trouble in 2015.
Right, two.
So that's it for this episode of the A to Z of David Bowie. But once again, before you go...
If you'd like to support us along the way and be a member of an exclusive Bowie club, you can. And here's how.
There's an exclusive Bowie members club called Cheap Things. And for just $5 a month, wow, you can be part of it.
Right. So now you're thinking $5 isn't much, but what exactly will I get for my hard-earned cash?
Well, in short, you'll get lots of great new exclusive material delivered to your door.
Well, computer, actually, Mark.
Via a system called Patreon.
That's right, Mark. Patreon is a payment system that allows you to contribute your monthly subscription and offers you a portal to access the exclusive material.
Material such as...
interviews with Bowie's cohorts and friends.
There'll be regular filmed Bowie quizzes.
Bowie guitar tutorials.
Unreleased archive written material.
Competitions.
And perhaps most impressively, short films featuring the Cheap Things team.
Ah, that'll be me, Mark, Howard Knock and Jason Reed.
Visiting various Bowie places of interest.
And much more besides.
All this for just $5 a month.
So if you can't resist, simply go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/cheapthings, or one word, and join up.
There's also a website,
bowiecheapthings.com.
Book early.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.